Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Elliot Mintzberg of People for the American Way Foundation, who examines charges that Republicans are working to prevent their opponents from voting and the measures being taken to protect the integrity of the November 2nd election. Green Party presidential candidate David Cobb, who discusses issues he says have been neglected by the Republicans and Democrats in the 2004 presidential campaign. And Craig Unger, author of the book House of Bush, House of Saud, who explains why he believes the ties between President Bush's family and the Saudi royals have compromised U.S. security and represents a unique and dangerous conflict of interest. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Citizens for Tax Justice reports that in the first 3 years of the Bush presidency, 82 of America's most profitable corporations paid no corporate income tax for at least 1 year. Fully one-third of the 275 Fortune 500 companies studied paid no taxes in the period examined, even though the blue-chip companies raked in $102 billion in pre-tax profits. In addition, the U.S. government sent back $12.6 billion in refunds to these same companies that face a statutory 35% corporate income tax rate. Among the companies with negative income tax rates are Pepco Holdings, Prudential Financial, ITT Industries, Boeing, Unisys, and CSX, the former employer of Jon Snow, the Bush administration's Secretary of the Treasury. New capital depreciation rules passed in 2002 and 2003 also cost the U.S. Treasury $175 billion, with these same companies enjoying the bulk of the tax write-off. Citizens for Tax Justice Director Robert McIntyre noted that these tax breaks create little economic benefit, stating that business investment is primarily driven by supply and demand, not by government attempts to micromanage the economy. One of the most intense battles over contracts to reconstruct Iraq is over cell phones. In the summer of 2003, Mother Jones magazine reports, the U.S. agency running Iraq, the Coalition Provisional Authority, issued a $2 billion contract establishing a wireless network. Iraq's new communications minister picked two Kuwaiti firms and an Egyptian company. That decision created havoc for Qualcomm, the California giant in cellular technology, because the firms picked used rival European technology called GSM, which is used in 70% of the world's cell phones. Qualcomm, with its partners Lucent Technology and Samsung, mobilized a massive lobbying campaign to reverse the decision and to ensure Qualcomm's patented CDMA technology was part of the contract for wireless phones for Iraqi police and fire departments. The Bush administration's Undersecretary of Defense John Shaw quickly became the point man for Qualcomm, who, along with Senator Conrad Burns, a Montana Republican, worked to get the telecom company's cell technology established in Iraq. Shaw used his power to investigate Qualcomm's rivals, who had won the wireless contract from the CPA. By the end of 2003, Shaw succeeded in replacing Iraq's communications minister and winning Qualcomm and Lucent its contract. In the process, Shaw and Qualcomm created a lot of ill feelings. Bonnie Carroll, a former communications advisor to the CPA in Baghdad, was disgusted with the hardball tactics. As Carroll told Mother Jones magazine, "We were used in an attempt to rig a contract. This is truly not my defense department." In 2000, Cuban Americans on both sides of the political fence in South Florida were galvanized by the election year volatility over the Elian Gonzalez case to help President Bush win the presidency. 4 years later, the unity among Cuban Americans has become fragmented as younger, more moderate Cubans are challenging the old right-wing Miami establishment. According to The Nation magazine, the outrage was caused by the latest draconian measures introduced by OFAC, the Office of Foreign Assets Control, and implemented in June of this year by the Bush administration. The new policy limits trips made to family members in Cuba to once every 3 years instead of one, and all but cuts off monetary donations that can be sent to relatives living in Cuba. The division in South Florida has reached the once monolithic Cuban American National Foundation. During the 1990s, its leader Jorge Mascanosa used to stroll into the White House and help to formulate policy around Cuba and the rest of Latin America. Former CANF Director and Castro foe Joe Garcia has even sent cables to the White House protesting the new Cuba policy. Now, older, more conservative Cubans in Miami are slowly being outnumbered by a younger, more progressive generation who have more familiar ties in Cuba. Traditionally Republican, the Cuban-American vote in Florida may now be up for grabs. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Zelfia Hunter.
In the weeks before Americans go to the polls to choose their next president, reports of organized efforts to intimidate voters or suppress the turnout have streamed in from across the country. Allegations of politically motivated conduct to disenfranchise voters have been widespread and focused particularly on Republican Party activities in battleground states. Charges include actions taken by state and local officials to deliberately place roadblocks to recording hundreds of thousands of newly registered voters, improperly purging voters with felony convictions, efforts to deter Native Americans from casting ballots, and plans to dispatch police and political activists to minority polling places in order to challenge likely Democratic voters. Florida, the center of the 2000 election debacle, is again the focus of controversy over alleged actions there by Governor Jeb Bush, the president's brother, to disenfranchise African Americans and other new voters. Sproul & Associates, a Republican Party consulting firm, is now under criminal investigation for allegedly posing as a nonpartisan group that signed up new voters in several swing states, processing forms signed by Republicans while discarding applications signed by Democrats. In the view of many, the flaws in new electronic voting machines present another threat to a clean election. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Elliot Mintzberg, vice president and legal director with People for the American Way Foundation, who examines the charges that Republicans are working to keep their opponents from voting and the measures being taken by the Election Protection Coalition to ensure that all eligible voters can cast a ballot and have their votes counted.
We know, for example, in Arizona that there's a group that's been supporting what's called an anti-immigrant initiative that has already said that they have plans to put people in dark T-shirts and possibly pistols at their sides outside Hispanic precincts in Arizona, trying to demand identification and obviously deter people from voting. We know that in Ohio, the state Republican Party has already stated that they're going to be challenging some 40,000 voters that they will contend should not be voting and that obviously will have a very negative effect. We know that in a number of states, state officials have put in restrictive rules that could threaten voters being able to cast a vote that counts on Election Day. A number of states have said, for example, that a so-called provisional ballot, a ballot that you cast under federal law when your name doesn't show up on the polls but you're sure that you're registered, that ballot has to be cast at the right precinct in order for it to count. So even if you're in Florida where a hurricane may have blown away your regular polling place, if you don't show up at the right precinct, that provisional ballot won't count at all, which obviously also has a significant chance of disenfranchising voters. Those are just several examples of potential problems around the country.
One other thing that's cropped up, we know now that a group called Sproul & Associates had been going around the country in some key battleground states, pawning itself off as a nonpartisan organization when in fact they were linked with the Republican Party. Accusations have been made, eyewitness accusations, that this company was disposing of any voters that they registered who turned out to be Democrat.
That's exactly right. The charges have been made that Sproul literally tore up voter registrations that were Democratic and didn't turn them in, and therefore there is certainly a risk, not only in those states, but perhaps in others, that some voters who think they have registered to vote, in fact, haven't been registered because their names never got to the election office. We're also concerned about the fact that even for many voters that did register, if their registration form was considered incomplete, even for a minor technical reason, at least in some states, that registration may be bounced and they won't have an opportunity to correct it before this year's election. And that is another factor that could wind up leading many voters not being able to vote.
Now, Florida, of course, was the center of a lot of attention and still is about what occurred during the 2000 presidential election. What do we know about problems there this year?
Well, several of the things I just mentioned are occurring in Florida. The restriction on provisional ballots, the problem with voter registrations that might have minor technical issues. The state of Florida is insisting that in addition to swearing that someone is a U.S. citizen, they must also check the box on the form that says they're a U.S. citizen, something that other states like Ohio have said really isn't necessary to be done in order for a person to be properly registered. Those problems exist in Florida. There are also problems with the electronic touchscreen machines and the lack of paper trail or a reliable way to recount those votes if necessary. There are problems in some areas where there have been large numbers of absentee ballots requested with people not having gotten their absentee ballot. So while some problems in Florida have been resolved in some way, we still have plenty of reason for concern in Florida as well.
People for the American Way Foundation and other groups have formed a very powerful coalition called the Election Protection Coalition. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing to prevent voter intimidation, fraud, and other problems that have plagued previous elections.
Well, the program really came out of the 2000 election, not who won or lost, but the terrible disenfranchisement of millions of voters that occurred. And we and the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights, the NAACP, many other civil rights groups are determined to try to make sure that doesn't happen again. So we've been working before the election to file lawsuits where necessary, work with election officials to resolve issues, and then on election day have three layers of protection for voters. We'll have a national hotline, 1-866-OUR-VOTE, that any voter can call if they're having problems voting. We'll have poll monitors at thousands of predominantly minority precincts and about 60 locations across the country to try to be there on the ground, help them at the precinct as needed. And third, we'll have lawyers and others standing by and in the field looking for issues and being there to help voters by talking with poll workers, with election officials, or if necessary, go to court to try to resolve these issues. Despite the kinds of problems we've talked about, what we want to do is make absolutely sure that people realize they've got someone there on election day to help protect them and to encourage them to go out and vote and reclaim our democracy.
That was Elliot Mintzberg, Vice President and Legal Director with People for the American Way Foundation. To get more information about the work of the Election Protection Coalition or to report election irregularities, call 1-866-OUR-VOTE toll-free or visit the coalition's website at www.electionprotection2004.com. Before John Kerry and George Bush held their third presidential debate, the Green Party published its list of a dozen issues and views it said had been censored from the debates by the two major candidates. Included on the list were positions advocating an end to the U.S. occupation of Iraq, criticism of attacks on civil liberties under the Patriot Act, rethinking the failed war on drugs, reversing the trend toward concentration of media ownership, support for a single-payer health care program, and more. The Greens charged that these issues and points of view were not heard in the debates because the Republican and Democratic candidates are on the same side, in stark contrast to positions advocated by the Green Party. David Cobb, an attorney from Texas, won the Green Party presidential nomination after a hotly contested race with Ralph Nader, who had sought the party's endorsement. Regarding the war in Iraq, Cobb says that if elected, he would immediately apologize to the Iraqi people for the war and denounce the withdrawal of U.S. troops. He would ask the United Nations to convene a pan-Arabic peace summit, inviting the civil society leadership of Iraq to attend, not the government installed by President Bush, to decide if they want a peacekeeping force under U.N. auspices. Lastly, Cobb says he would direct the billions of dollars in reconstruction funds currently going to U.S. contractors to Iraqi companies and workers instead. Between the lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with David Cobb about some of the other issues he says have been neglected in the 2004 presidential campaign.
The war in Iraq was about oil, and the overwhelming majority of Americans know it, and Bush and Kerry never talk about it again because they are lying to the American people. So if we want to actually move towards genuine global security, we must wean ourselves off of the addiction to oil that's driving not only the war, but also global warming and environmental destruction. And the reality is that there are alternative energy sources available right now: solar power, wind power, geothermal power, tidal power, that are not being implemented because we, the people, don't control energy policy in this country. Science and technology is not the problem. The problem is that unelected and unaccountable corporate CEOs have hijacked not only our government, but our institutions and our culture. The Green Party is building a movement in order to move towards sustainable alternative energy sources. And it doesn't just stop with the production of energy, but the Green Party is also calling for a massive infrastructure development for an intrastate train system and an inner city mass trolley system to return to the days of genuine mass transit in this country before General Motors and Firestone and all the rest of the automobile corporations and oil corporations destroyed mass transit in this country.
Do you see any difference between Kerry and Bush on energy policy?
There's a difference between Bush and Kerry on energy policy, but not enough of a difference. But there are a difference. You know, I say it this way. John Kerry is a corporatist militarist who voted for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. He voted for No Child Left Behind, which is devastating public schools in this country. He voted for NAFTA, which is destroying both our wages and environmental protections in this country. John Kerry voted for the Patriot Act. John Kerry opposes single-payer universal health care, and he opposes raising the minimum wage to a living wage. However, as bad as I think John Kerry is, I will acknowledge that George W. Bush is qualitatively worse. Bush is a genuine threat to the planet. He and his neoconservative cabal are moving this country ever more swiftly in exactly the wrong direction.
Healthcare is a huge issue in this campaign. How does the Green Party's position differ from that of the two major parties?
It's true that Kerry and Bush have different plans, but they're both plans predicated upon leaving healthcare in the hands of the pharmaceutical corporations and the insurance corporations so that they ultimately have final decision on who actually gets health care in this country. The Green Party's plan is fundamentally different. We say that health care should not be a commodity that's bought and paid for at a profit, the way Bush and Kerry say. The Green Party says health care should be a fundamental human right and that everyone should have access to health care. And the only way to make that happen is for us to develop a universal single-payer health care system where everybody has access to health care. We eliminate the pharmaceutical corporations and the health insurance corporations. We allow individuals to choose their own doctors, and we ensure that doctors only have one form to submit for payment and that the payment always comes from one payer, the national government, so that costs come down.
Have you had the opportunity to talk to people who aren't already converted, and do they agree with you when they hear what you have to say?
You know, I can't tell you the number of people who have contacted our campaign after hearing us on PBS or CNN or C-SPAN who say, you know, I had never heard of the Green Party or I didn't know about the Green Party, but y'all make sense. You're telling the truth about the problems that face this country, and you've got simple solutions to all of them. The reason that the Green Party is not more successful is not because of our positions. The problem is a voting system that forces people to feel like they must vote against what they hate rather than for what they actually want. The solution is to change our voting system to an instant runoff voting where voters are empowered to rank order their choices. It's as easy as 1, 2, 3 because voters would be able to say, well, my first preference is, my second preference is, my third preference is. It would eliminate the spoiler effect, eliminate the wasted vote phenomenon, and guarantee that we have a majority winner and do it with only one election.
That was Green Party presidential candidate David Cobb. For more information, call his campaign toll-free at 1-866-472-5787. @41Green or visit his website at www.votecobb.org. In the groundbreaking film documentary Fahrenheit 9/11, director Michael Moore confronted millions of Americans with disturbing questions about the conduct of President Bush before and after the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. The filmmaker asked tough questions about why some 140 Saudis, 24 of them members of Osama bin Laden's family, were allowed to fly out of the country on September 13, 2001, during a time when virtually all other air traffic was grounded. 15 of the 19 hijackers involved in the September 11th attacks were Saudis. In answering that question, Moore revealed the many financial and social links between the president's family and the Saudi royals. Much of the information about the Bush-Saudi connection, seen in Fahrenheit 9/11, came from award-winning investigative journalist Craig Unger's best-selling book, House of Bush, House of Saud, The Secret Relationship Between the World's Two Most Powerful Dynasties. As voters prepare to go to the polls for the November 2nd presidential election, Between the Lines Scott Harris spoke with Craig Unger about why he believes the ties between these two families have compromised U.S. security and represents a dangerous conflict of interest for a president unique in American history.
Well, this is an extraordinary relationship that I think is completely unprecedented in the history of the White House. And by that, I mean never before has any president, much less two presidents from the same family, had such a close relationship with another ruling family as the Bush family has had with the Saudis. And this is a relationship that goes back more than 20 years. I traced a total of $1.4 billion in investments and contracts going from the Saudis to companies in which the Bushes and their allies have major roles. I'm talking about Harkin Energy, where George W. Bush was on the board of directors. It was a small independent oil company in Texas, and the Saudis bailed it out. I'm talking about Halliburton, where Dick Cheney was CEO, and the biggest was the Carlyle Group, where both George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush were part of it. It's an extraordinarily personal relationship as well. Bush Sr. was very, very close to Prince Bandar, for example, the Saudi ambassador to the United States. They would go on hunting trips together. Prince Bandar, who's a member of the royal family, would visit the Bush household in Kennebunkport, Maine. He'd drop by Crawford, Texas, or even the White House uninvited and stay for dinner. Barbara Bush was very strict about not smoking in the house, and she wouldn't allow anyone in the world to smoke in the house except for Prince Bandar. And on September 13th, just 2 days after 9/11, Bandar came to the White House, and to me it's quite extraordinary. We knew that 15 out of 19 hijackers were Saudis. We knew that bin Laden and al-Qaeda were Saudi and were funded by Saudis largely. This is, to me, is where the war on terrorism should have begun. President Bush should have cracked down here. He should have demanded transparency into the Islamist charities that were funding the terrorists, but he did not. And instead, this was a time when air traffic was basically shut down. It was just starting to reopen. Private aviation was still banned on that day, and planes began to fly. A first flight required White House approval, and it got it, and the Saudis were not seriously investigated.
There have been accusations leveled at the Saudi family. Members of the royal family itself are contributors to the al-Qaeda cause, and I wonder if you just talk a little bit more about that.
Well, absolutely. I mean, in fact, Prince Bandar's wife, it's been widely reported, indirectly aided two of the hijackers. And this became an issue before the Senate Intelligence Committee, which was investigating 9/11. And Senator Bob Graham, among others, was investigating this. He had subpoenaed for the Senate Intelligence Committee an FBI informant who was going to testify about this. But the White House interceded. They stopped the investigation. They would not allow the testimony to take place. And they censored 28 pages of this report that had to do with the Saudis. And Senator Graham concluded that Saudi officials themselves, these were not just individuals, but officials in the Saudi government had, in fact, funded 9/11, and the Bush administration really shut down this part of the investigation. And Senator Graham concluded that they cared more about their relationship with Saudi Arabia than with getting to the bottom of 9/11 and the victims of the attacks.
What do you feel voters should know before they cast a ballot in this presidential election, taken from your work in the book House of Bush, House of Saud, the relationship between the Bush family and the Saudi royal family?
Right, well, it's very clear that presidential elections actually deal with the issues that we're going to be facing in the next few years. But I think if there's one lesson I've learned from this is I fear that President Bush, that his policies towards the Middle East are leaving us with the worst of both worlds. And by that I mean that in his relationship with the Saudis, that he's been so close to them, that I think he's been soft on terrorism, that he's not probed into the root causes of terrorism, which has to do with the Saudis and how they finance it. Instead, he went into Iraq, which had nothing to do with 9/11, and I think he's created a problem there that will incite more and more terrorists. In addition, what is our energy policy? And it appears that in going to Iraq, they just sort of wanted to take over the oil fields, and we're not being successful at that. Iraq was producing about 3 million barrels a day of oil under Saddam Hussein, which at least was making it out onto the world market. Now it's producing less than 1 million a day. And the Iraqi war is evolving into an oil war. This is becoming what could be a series of great oil wars. And I think we need to change our policy dramatically. And I think it's going to be very difficult. I think going into Iraq was one of those irrevocable, catastrophic blunders that you just can't take back. And that we need a president who will repair our alliances with Europe, which I think can be done. And then we'll try to do that in the Middle East as well, which I think is going to be much, much more difficult. And at the same time, we'll start a very, very serious alternative energy program, because sometime in the next 10 years, if not sooner, we could all be running on empty. We have 165 million automobiles, and this country needs gas. I lived through the OPEC oil embargo back in the 70s, and it had disastrous consequences for the economy, and next time around it could be much worse.
That was Craig Unger, award-winning investigative journalist and author of the book House of Bush, House of Saud, The Secret Relationship Between the World's Two Most Powerful Dynasties, published by Scribner. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio, and where you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Zofia Hunter, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Vanzari.